Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Critically Reclaimed, the podcast where we review stuff. My name is William Bibbiani. Everyone calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold, and today we are going to raise the Titanic from a pup. Raised it from a pup, I did.
We'll get to that in a minute. All right. And we'll introduce the title proper, and then we'll play a clip. But yeah, this is the podcast where we look back at all of the catalog titles that are on the various streaming services that people are watching nowadays. Mm-hmm. And instead of looking at the new stuff, we're looking at the old stuff, the stuff that often gets overlooked. The older films that maybe you've seen before and haven't thought of in a while, or maybe the ones you've never bothered to watch.
Either way, these are films one of us hasn't seen.
Yes, that's the rule. At least one of us has to have not seen the movie in question, so one of us is discovering something anew. But sometimes, one of us will be revisiting an old friend. And either way, all of our films on Critically Reclaimed are curated by our listeners on Patreon. Patreon.com/Critically Acclaimed Network is the name of our Patreon, in addition to exclusive shows dedicated to every single film ever nominated for Best Picture, every episode of the 1960s Batman, every episode of Star Trek ever made, commentary tracks, and whatnot. We also have polls to help decide future episodes of the show, and every week our patrons get to decide which film on a particular streaming service Whitney and I are going to watch. And this time, we decided to head on over to everyone's favorite bargain bin. Tubi.
The UHF dial of the streaming era.
Yeah. Most of the big streamers that you're aware of, your Netflixes, your Disney channels, your HBO minuses.
All the big corporate rock.
Yeah. They're mostly, like, they have all of their, like, premium content, and, like, if they have older stuff, it's, like, a bit more of a hodgepodge. Tubi has all the old crap. Like, all of it. Like, it's like an astounding amount. And this is a free service. They have a lot of ads, but not as many as you might think. They're not, like, as... They're about as pervasive as if you were watching it on TV. So about every 10, 15 minutes or so. Yeah. So it's not too bad. Better than YouTube a lot of the time, I'll tell you that much.
Which will interrupt a video mid-sentence to show you an ad.
Yeah. The other day I was watching a video on YouTube. There were 30 seconds to go in the video, and they interrupted it for an ad. Fuck
like
you.
30 seconds to go.
My God. That's like interrupting a movie for a commercial and then showing the credits. Come on. We waited for you. But Tubi has a lot of the weirder, older stuff and newer stuff as well. It's actually got a pretty good selection overall. And so we wanted to look at the various thrillers that were available on Tubi that Whitney or myself had never seen. And we wagered to our patrons 4 films. And in return, they raised the Titanic.
I think we hit the jackpot.
It's at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean.
You're talking about 12,500 feet underwater.
Which leaves us with only one choice.
Are you talking about raising the Titanic?
Yeah. It's the biggest job with the highest stakes anybody ever dreamt of.
Raise the Titanic is one of, it's not talked about very often anymore, it's one of the biggest box office bombs ever.
Ever. This is a big, expensive thing. And this,
huge.
This came at the... I guess it was dying out. It was sort of on the sliding edge of that big wave of 1970s sort of spectacle/disaster movies. I think it's not technically a disaster film.
But it's adjacent.
It has that vibe.
Well, it's
to
about
it.
The Titanic. There are disasters that occur as they go underwater to find the Titanic. And so it's, I think, although some might call it a bit more of like an exploration movie or more of a spy movie. Mm. I think if you had, like, you know, like Criterion does their thing where here are, like, 20 neo-noirs to discover. Mm-hmm. If you were looking at, like, 20 disaster movies and one of them was Raise the Titanic, I would go, yeah.
You wouldn't really bat
that. Yeah, that's fair. That's fine. That's an adjunct.
And the director of this, Jerry Jameson, also did one of the Airport sequels.
Yeah,
so,
I think, 77, I think.
Airport 77.
Yeah.
Look up those Airport movies. They were huge.
One of the biggest motion picture franchises of, like, the second half of the 20th century. And nobody talks about them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They're Oscar winning.
Yeah.
Those movies.
And huge stars were in these things. These were a big, big deal in the 70s. And, they were, they weren't critically acclaimed. They were considered kind of like junky fluff, which they were.
Yeah.
But
a lot of the disaster movies are junky fluff, and a lot of them were nominated for like Best Picture and shit.
So no matter how popular the thing you like is, it could fall away really at any minute.
You never know. Give it a couple of decades. Some of your favorite thing will be obscure.
Raise the Titanic, I think, was destined to be obscure.
Mm-hmm.
Raise the Titanic is about, it's enough story for a 30-minute sitcom.
It's actually shocking how little story there is.
Yeah, there's almost no story to this thing.
This is based off of the first, I almost said Dirk Benedict, and that's wrong.
That's a Clive Cussler novel.
Yeah. It's a Clive Cussler novel about Dirk Pitt, who is a character who, after selling the rights to Raise the Titanic...
Mm.
Clive Cussler hated the movie so much that he vowed he would never let them make another Dirk Pitt movie. And then about 20-something years go by, and he said, okay, fine, you can make Sahara. And then they made Sahara. And then they made Sahara with Matthew McConaughey. That was also one of the biggest, most notorious bombs in history. And also Clive Cussler didn't like the movie. So... this character, a lot of people consider Dirk Pitt to be like one of these like great literary characters, like Jack Ryan or Alex Cross, who's like sort of could totally carry like a whole movie franchise, but cursed, doomed with these movies.
I don't know about Dirk Pitt as a character. No, like I haven't read the Clive Cussler novels.
I saw Sahara when it came out, but I think I was stoned. I don't remember anything about it, or maybe it was just boring. It could be one.
Dirk Pitt is played by actor Richard Jordan in this film. Richard Jordan is he's got a face you'd recognize.
Does he?
I recognized him from Dune.
Okay.
He had a role in Dune, but I've seen him like in supporting roles in a lot of movies.
I recognized him from Warrior of the Lost World, and then I realized, wait, I'm thinking of Robert Ginty, aka the paper chase guy.
He is not Robert Ginty.
He's got a Robert Ginty-ish quality.
He is Gintier than most.
he's got like a kind of a thick beard, and he doesn't really have like. This movie is clearly evoking or attempting to evoke some James Bond vibes. It's got a big cast. It's got a big, big Alec Guinness is in it. Big British actors are in it. John Barry did the score, and boy, does it sound like everything John Barry ever did. John Barry is one of those composers. He did the James Bond theme. He did the theme for Black Hole, which we covered not that long ago on the show.
Spectacular, but very shallow movie, Black Hole.
Yeah, yeah. Gorgeous epic, but like not a great story. John Barry tends to make scores that sound like John Barry scores. And then when they're great, they're great. And when they're not, they sound like he's reusing old tracks. Yeah. And this one sounds like he's reusing old tracks.
You can accuse most composers of doing that.
Oh, sure.
They work with certain types of sounds, don't they? Mm-hmm. You can spot a John Williams score.
Hans Zimmer, I remember being vaguely offended when we watched, I think, Drop Zone.
Mm.
And Hans Zimmer did the score to Drop Zone. And one of my favorite Hans Zimmer bits is his bit from Pirates of the Caribbean, that rousing ba-da-bum bum ba-da-bum bum ba-da-bum bum ba-da-bum bum ba-da-bum bum ba-da-bum bum ba-da-bum bum.
It's a good one.
He uses a lot of that stuff in Drop Zone. Like he cribbed a lot of pirates from Drop Zone.
Yeah, okay.
Like it's kind of amazing.
What movie?
No, the one he used in that one was bum 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 ba-dum bum 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 ba-dum. Bum 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 bum, bum 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 bum.
That sounds like bum, bum, is that Pirates bum, or that Drop Zone?
It's Drop Zone on the Alien Pirates. I got the track wrong, but yeah.
Butter da da dum, butter da dum 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 dum. That is.
Is that a commercial jingle?
Well, you're thinking of National Geographic.
Yes.
I was singing Danny Elfman's Batman music.
Oh. You didn't hold it out long enough. Ba bum bum. If you held it out a little longer.
Bum bum bum. Now, like the year later, we got bum 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 bum, which is Dick Tracy.
Very similar.
It's the same music almost. I've seen those movies a lot, so I can hum their scores.
Yeah. I apologize if anyone's bored out of their mind right now. Anyway, John Barry did the score to Raise the Titanic. It's got a lot of spy stuff in it. This was considered not just like a big epic film, an adaptation of a successful novel, a big gigantic undertaking, visual effects-wise.
But it was huge budget.
Could possibly launch a franchise. Like, this was going to be a big deal. And It cost way too fucking much.
$40 million and $1980.
Which I think, let me double check my math on that, but I think that's like $180 million today.
In 2021 dollars. And yeah. It made $7 million.
Yeah.
And you don't need inflation to know that it didn't make its money back.
Yeah, people were not interested.
Richard Jordan was the main character. He's Dirk Pitt. But I think the big stars, they got Ann Archer, they got Jason Robards, and they got Alec Guinness in a small part.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, this was around the time Alec Guinness would sort of wander in front of a camera if you just sort of said, hey, like that you float a check in front of him and he'll sort of walk in front of the camera for you. But he'll do a professional job, of course, because he's a complete professional.
Yeah, yeah.
But he said no to little.
Yes, that's very, very true. So the plot of the movie, Raise the Titanic. America needs a laser shield.
Go on.
And in order to power this laser shield to protect us from the Russians, we need to get basically unobtainium.
It's called Byzantium. It's like... Yeah. It's this unknown element. While looking in a mine, they found evidence that somebody might have had this element called Byzantium, which is the element they need to make this thing.
And unfortunately, the entire supply of Byzantium, or is it Byzantium?
It's Byzantium.
Byzantium. Basically the whole world's supply of Byzantium was in one place. The fucking Titanic.
Yeah, they found that Byzantium was being carried on board the Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
And, this one guy had it, and we put it in a safe. They found, like, a letter indicating that he had it, so they knew, okay, so we know now, and this is, and it takes them, like, 30 minutes of the movie to figure this out.
Yeah.
We now know that this is at the bottom of the Atlantic somewhere, so we have to, A, find the Titanic, and the pressure is too great to dive. We can't go down there.
And we didn't have, like, these awesome robot subs that could go down to, like, the Mariana Trench.
Or whatever they were. Yeah,
So, like, so they have to, in order to retrieve this shit, they have to raise the Titanic from the ocean depths back to the surface. Mm. Which is admittedly quite an idea. It's a really fanciful idea. And it's worth remembering that in 1980...
We didn't know where it was yet.
We didn't know where the Titanic was. We had a general sense. It's probably in the Atlantic Ocean somewhere. Mm-hmm. And there are, like, general ideas where it's probably in this grid somewhere, but that's a gigantic...
That's why the James Cameron movie about the Titanic was such a coup. Because he used actual footage he shot of the Titanic on the ocean's floor because it had only recently, like a few years before, been discovered.
Yeah, they discovered the Titanic, and they also discovered a bunch of things about the Titanic that they didn't know before. Mm-hmm. So Raise the Titanic... is spectacularly inaccurate. It's actually, apparently, except for one thing.
Hmm.
By sheer mind-blowing coincidence, or maybe Clive Cussler did, like, really, really good research, the actual, like, depth the Titanic was at was nearly accurate.
Oh, nice.
And Raised the Titanic. Like, it was surprisingly close to where it was actually, like, located in terms of the depth of the ocean floor.
They did know that it was sunk via... a collision with an iceberg.
Yeah, people survived. So, people saw it. Yeah, people knew what happened. But one of the things they didn't know was that it cracked in half.
Mm-hmm.
People thought the Titanic sunk
a hole was, like, ripped in the side and just water came in and it sunk. Yeah,
people remembered seeing the Titanic, like, you know, when it goes, like, all the way upright, like, perpendicular to the water.
Mm-hmm.
But what they didn't remember was it cracking in half. So we didn't know that until we found the Titanic.
Mm.
So in Raise the Titanic, when they pull the Titanic up to the surface of the ocean, it's intact.
It's just complete, and they've patched the hole. That's the only thing that's the problem. They somehow got down there, patched the hole, pumped the water out, and raised it up to the surface.
It's really interesting to watch these movies that were trying to be, like, trying to appeal to, like, history nerds or science nerds, but they're going with the information we had at the time.
Mm.
There's a really good example of this. It's a sci-fi movie called Robinson Crusoe on Mars.
I haven't seen Robinson Crusoe on Mars.
It's very, very fun. But basically, it's the Robinson Crusoe story, except a couple of astronauts are orbiting Mars. Their ship crashes. One of them dies. The one who dies is played by Adam West, by the way. And the other one survives. And at the time, the movie was being marketed as the most scientifically accurate Mars movie ever.
Mm.
So it was full of things that we knew about Mars, like there's water and some oxygen. Like, these are people thought there were canals on Mars for a while just because based on what we were seeing from telescopes. We didn't have more accurate telescopes. We didn't have more accurate information than that. So the movie was considered, except for like the last act where there are aliens attacking and everything. They were going for accuracy. Mm. But watch it now and it's very quaint.
Yeah.
And that's true for Raising the Titanic as well, which is extra embarrassing because they were really taking this shit seriously.
They were taking it really seriously. And it's presented in this incredibly earnest, almost Roland Emmerich-like clunkiness.
Mm-hmm.
Where we're going to sort of circle the globe and there's a lot of foreboding and a lot of mystery as to where the Titanic is. And yeah, a lot of unpacking about the little details. I don't trust any movie poster that advertises a film as accurate.
Yeah.
Some are, but if they are, they probably don't advertise that fact.
I think the movie The Human Centipede ruined that.
Oh, yeah, 100% medically accurate. I don't want any movie to ever advertise itself as medically accurate.
No, thank you.
About anything.
No.
The films that are most accurate, from what I understand, the sciences are very accurate. Even though it's a science fiction film, the sciences are quite accurate in the film The Martian, the Ridley Scott film.
Oh, yeah, I heard they were trying to be very careful.
It's clearly not possible, but they were trying to make it look as possible as possible.
If you're fictionalizing anything, you've got to make something up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I know Master and Commander of the Far Side of the World is notoriously accurate, down to like details about the costumes and power structure.
That's historically accurate. Historically accurate. Scientifically accurate. Yeah.
This one is being presented incredibly frankly, as if they're giving you a lecture.
Mm-hmm.
And before they find the Titanic, they give like a press conference. We know it's somewhere here, and they triangulate
and they show models, and here's how it's going to work. And they're very impressed with themselves. And honestly, and again, you look back, and it's like, it's a movie about raising the Titanic. It sounds absurd. But if you consider it just for a moment...
Mm.
If you consider this as a romantic notion, we're going to take this ship that at the time was still lost.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to find it. That in and of itself is an adventure.
Yeah.
We're going to find it, and we're going to use the latest technology and the most up-to-date science possible to lift the Titanic out of the ocean so we can walk around on it.
Mm-hmm.
If they actually did this, if they actually lifted the Titanic out of the ocean and you could walk around on it, wouldn't you wanna?
Yeah, absolutely.
Of course I would. That's a fascinating idea. The problem with this movie is that, and I haven't read the book. Mm. Maybe the book is far more interesting. They don't have anything else really to go along with that. Everything surrounding that is like the vague idea of a story, but they never actually do it. Here's an example. We're introduced to a bunch of characters who are trying to get this laser missile defense system off the ground.
Mm.
And they're concerned that the Russians are going to find out about it. When they find out that this shit is missing and they need to possibly go to the depth of the ocean to find it, they enlist Dirk Pitt.
Mm.
Dirk Pitt comes with a bit of legend to him. He is spoken of in hushed tones. He will only take assignments that are considered impossible. That kind of thing.
What is he exactly like? What is his job? Because that is really unclear to me.
He's an independent contractor, basically, who's and I think he's essentially a pirate. Like he does sea stuff. This is how he's presented in the movie.
He's like a freelance pirate.
He does ocean salvage. He'll do certain amounts of exploration. He solves. Mm-hmm. He's basically Indiana Jones. We didn't have Indiana Jones yet, by the way.
That's true.
He's basically kind of a proto Indiana Jones in a lot of ways. He's out there to dig up history, fight bad guys, or he would if they ever showed up and did more than issue vague threats.
Mm.
The point I was going to bring up is it turns out that one of these scientists who is responsible for this laser system, turns out he's dating Dirk's ex-girlfriend. She's played by Ann Archer from Fatal Attraction, and she would also be Harrison Ford's wife in the Jack Ryan movies, which is where I recognized her from. I was like, how do I know her? Oh, that's right, Jack Ryan movies. She's great, by the way. She has nothing to do, but she's really good in this. She brings a lot of energy and life to a movie that mostly has none. And the whole thing is like, oh, so this Dirk Pitt guy, he seems cool. Did you know him? And she's like, we met. Cool. Later on, okay, fine, we live together for a year. Oh,
You could have.
Are you going to go back to him or something? No. Oh! Was this ever going anywhere? No. In fact, the Archer isn't in the second half of the movie. Oh. Why? They don't really think this shit out. That's drama. That's melodrama, but it's drama.
The director of this film is just looking over his filmography. Did mostly TV. He's best known for TV. He did some features, but he mostly did like one episode of every hot 70s TV program.
Yeah, his name is Jerry Jameson.
Yeah, Jerry Jameson, who, look over, it's like...
Yeah, he did the Mod Squad, he did Cannon, the $6 Million Man, McCloud, Hawaii 5-0.
Ironside.
Superdome, High Noon Part 2. The TV sequel to High Noon.
Yeah, a lot of TV and TV movies. And this feels like he's finally allowed to sort of stretch a little bit.
Yeah.
He's making a film that's almost 2 hours in length and doesn't have the strictures of needing to put in like commercial breaks or worry about TV censorship. Pace it however he wants. And as such, it feels like he's indulging himself a little bit. Why do we have the Ann Archer story in here? Well, I wouldn't be allowed to do that in a TV movie. That's a note you'd get from a studio. Mm. Cut that character.
We don't need it.
We don't need it. It's not
adding to the plot. Doesn't tie into anything.
But, I want to give Ann Archer work. I think she's a good actress. Mm. I think it would be interesting to give Dirk a little bit of a backstory with another character.
Yeah.
Allow both of those characters to sort of thrive a little bit. I'm going to put them all in the movie.
Right.
It's like, okay, fine. We'll cut it out in editing. So who's editing? Oh, shit, you forgot. You forgot to cut out that character. it feels like
he's... You could cut all of her scenes in the movie would be the same.
Yeah, not a...
And it's a shame, because actually plot, she's giving one of the most engaging performances in the movie, plot, but she and the characters, need to be there.
Yeah, would not be altered one whit with her excision from this film. But, yeah, which is a pity, because Ann Archer is good.
Yeah.
I feel like this was a chance to do something that he couldn't do on TV.
Right.
That's the reason a lot of these... It starts so slow. Why it doesn't get to the climax until like way late in the film.
Which is weird to me, because to me this movie plays like a TV miniseries. Like this movie plays like we have way more time to fill than we needed. Mm. Because again, here's... I'm going to give you the plot of the movie in bullet points. Mm. Okay? We need to get this Byzantium. It's on the Titanic. Hey Dirk, you want to go find the Titanic? Yes. Hey, Dirk, did you find the Titanic? Yes. What are we going to do? We're going to raise that shit. Cool. We're going to go get the Titanic. Oh, no, some people died. Is that important? Not really. Okay. Oh, no, some people get stuck on the Titanic. Oh, well, are they going to die? No, because we're going to raise that shit. Cool. Is that going to take a long time? It was supposed to take us like a whole bunch of weeks. No, we can do it in an hour. Okay, so we're going to do that. Cool. Oh, hey, the Russians are here. And the Russians are like, hey, fuck off. This is our Titanic. And they're just like, nuh-uh. And the Russians are like, well, we could do some stuff. And Dirk is like, yeah, we have the American military. And Russia's like, oh, we forgot about that. And then they fuck off. And then it turns out the Byzantium wasn't on the Titanic. The end. There's not a lot of movie there.
No, there is a twist as to where it was.
I don't want to ruin it. Right. I don't want to ruin the last thing in the movie, but like, it's also really telegraphed. It's also really, really telegraphed.
I liked the scenes where after they've risen, there's this big sequence where they're swimming around underwater, and we've commented on this before. Underwater sequences are death.
They're slow. They're murky.
Unless you're James Cameron making a documentary film, getting these like high tech cameras and swimming them around undersea and giving me facts while I'm watching this stuff, it's not a good way to increase tension.
At least not if you're doing it the way it actually is. Maybe Avatar 2 will find a way to make it really exciting.
Even like underwater horror films, like Underwater.
Mm-hmm.
There's this long sequence in Underwater where Kristen Stewart's in a scuba suit wandering around on the ocean floor and you can't see a damn thing.
Yeah.
Because like she has limited visibility. There's a lot of silt in the water and like her lights are reflecting off of it and she's supposed to be scared of something. Mm-hmm. And I'm just watching a bunch of like particles floating around on a black screen.
Yeah. It's
and it goes on and on and on.
It's interminable. And
so all of this stuff about raising the Titanic and swimming around and all this impressive underwater photography is really dull.
Yeah. It shouldn't be. It should be the most thrilling thing ever.
John Barry's giving his all. He's trying to music it up. But
John Barry isn't giving it exciting music. He's giving this like almost foreboding music. He does that whole da na na na
I'll say this. If you really, really, really liked that scene in Star Trek The Motion Picture, where where you just look at the ship for a couple minutes,
yeah.
you're going to love the sequences from Raise the Titanic, because there's a lot of these glory shots just panning over the underwater ship. And they did do a good job of making it look large.
Oh, yeah. The scale of it's actually quite impressive. I got to give them that. The model itself, they give a whole bunch of like up-close detailed shots where they still manage to capture the enormity of it, because it's a giant model, obviously. It looks good. It's a great looking model. Like, if there's an Oscar just for models, I give it to that movie, by all means. What was I going to say? I was thinking, you were saying that underwater scenes in movies are always death. I can think of one example that actually leans into the stuff that usually fucks up other movies. And that's the original 47 Meters Down.
How so?
You ever see that movie?
Yeah.
Okay, so the idea
of trapped in a cage at the bottom of the ocean.
A couple of novice divers are in a shark cage for like a tourist thing, and then the cage ends up getting severed from the boat and falling 47 meters down into the ocean. And in that one, they've chummed the water, so they're surrounded by angry sharks. In that case, they're not moving around a lot at all anyway, so the slowness doesn't really affect anything. It's a claustrophobic. But
it's about being trapped in one spot.
Yeah. And also, the low visibility means that there could be a shark 5 feet from you and you have no idea. And so when they move their head and there's a little light flashes and you just capture that one shark eye, it's actually really scary. I think that's one where they actually knew the problems involved with shooting underwater and they decided to make that the thing that made it suspenseful. But most movies are acting as though we'll be fine with watching scuba divers swim slowly for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's boring. I'm just going to say it. Stop doing that shit. Trying to think of other things to say.
Once it's risen.
Yeah.
Once they do all of that underwater nonsense, and it takes a long portion of
and
the movie.
And they walk around in it. It looks cool.
When they're walking around in it, I like that part.
It's awesome.
This, like, fantasy that you could raise the Titanic, and it's all kind of, like, rotten and dripping, but it's, like, intact enough that you could explore it, and they're going, like, breaking into safes and stuff.
Yeah.
That shit's cool. That's, like, fun pulp movie adventure stuff.
Yeah.
I like that.
Like the movie Ghost Ship.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is a better movie than this, which is sad because Ghost Ship isn't that good.
It's not that good.
The opening is amazing. The first, like, five minutes of Ghost Ship is astonishingly good.
How we learn how the ship became a ghost ship is pretty interesting because we get to see that right in the opening scene.
Oh, that opening scene. Ghost Ship is one of the best opening scenes of any horror movie. Period. And I know what that says. If you've never seen it, you know what I'm talking about. If you haven't seen it, you have no idea what I'm talking about. You should totally see it.
An actor named Ron Eldard is in that movie, and he was a regular customer at the movie theater where I worked,
so I got to
sort of talk to him a lot, and I watched Ghost Ship, and then he came in, and I got to ask him, did he actually eat real maggots? Because there's a scene where characters are eating food,
and they don't realize they're maggots.
They don't realize it's ghost food, and they look up, and there's like maggots spilling out
the
of their mouths.
The Lost Boys, you've seen that now. You've seen Lost Boys.
I've seen
the maggots.
I finally watched
Lost
Boys.
You're eating maggots,
Boys.
Michael.
Motherfucking maggots, how do they work? And
maggots. You know what, we're stopping. I don't mean to gross anybody. I'm quoting Garth Brink.
And he leans forward, and he has the ICP makeup. Ron Eldred had to put like a big spoonful of real maggots in his mouth and then spit them all out. So I got to ask him about that. Did you actually eat maggots? He's like, yeah, that was a miserable day of shooting.
Oh, God. He really did that?
He really did that. I mean, he's devoted to his craft. He didn't mind. But yeah,
it's still gross, though.
It's like, yeah.
No one's looking forward to that shit.
It's like, yeah, those are real maggots.
Wow.
Yep, put them in my mouth.
Ron, I'm going to say this right now. Ron Eldred, if you're listening, and I'm sure you are, because we know how much you love Race to Titanic. Ron, you didn't get paid enough on Ghost Ship, buddy.
Yeah, whatever it was, they should have paid you more.
They should have doubled that shit.
Also, you're really good in The Last Supper. I like Ron Eldard.
I was quite a fan of When Trumpets Fade.
I heard that was good.
It was a World War II movie. It was made for HBO. Came out the same year as Saving Private Ryan, so nobody talked about it. Really good cast. Really well made. It's very kind of bitter and dark World War II movie. Like, not a lot of rah-rah shit. It's actually very sad and pointed. And that movie's great. If you ever get a chance to see When Trumpets Fade, I highly recommend it. But we're not talking about Raise the Titanic because there's shockingly little to discuss. That's the thing. It's a 2-hour movie and almost nothing happens in it.
Well, and the big climax is once they've raised the Titanic, technically they're in international waters.
Uh-huh.
So, and there's Russians that were helping them do this, like actual Soviet scientists. And so they're wandering around the Titanic. They're like, okay, now we have the Titanic. And the Russian pulls a gun on them. Like a single handgun is going to rob the entire Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, okay, now all you Americans go and we'll just salvage this Titanic for ourselves.
And we'll keep the Byzantium for our own. And we'll keep the Byzantium
for ourselves. And they're, yeah. And they're like, no. They're like Charles Grodin. No. No. No.
Yeah. But I would really, really like to commandeer your Titanic. Yeah.
No.
Please?
I happen to know you can't commandeer the Titanic. Does this gun bother you? No, it's one of my favorite.
Which one of the Ghostbusters movies had the Titanic actually showing up in New York Harbor?
That was the second one.
Was that the second one? Okay. Because they clearly saw Save the Titanic.
No, Raise the Titanic. No,
sorry, it's Raise the Titanic, sorry. Yeah. Think of Save the Tiger. Save the Tiger, Raise the Titanic, Hang 'em High. You know, they're all the same.
Hmm. Raise the Tiger. There's a tiger at the bottom of the Atlantic. How'd it get there? That's an interesting story. It's
bringing up baby, except there's a tiger on the Titanic.
raising up baby. Bringing up the Titanic. It was a baby once.
Oh, my God.
It was born as a tugboat.
This is, when James Cameron made Titanic, by the way, James Cameron's Titanic is great.
I hated Titanic when it first came out, like a lot of hipsters at the time.
Yeah.
I was in college.
James Cameron
too
movies.
Too cool for the room. Well, I actually
pulpy romance.
I actually wasn't. The only James Cameron film I had seen up to that point were the first two Terminator films.
Oh, okay.
But it was one of these things like, oh, it's really popular. This is the 90s. We're kind of thumbing our noses at that kind of stuff. Mm. And my sister actually put it very, very, very well. She said she saw it and she cried. Mm. And then she was immediately angry at the man for making her cry. But you look at it and this is sort of like the pinnacle of pop filmmaking. Like it doesn't really get any slicker than this production.
Yeah.
It's got everything about it is satisfying. It doesn't have like any kind of holes in it.
Little tiny thing, but who gives a shit? Like he talks about a lake that didn't exist.
Whatever.
Yet. Who cares?
It has some of most of James Cameron's movies, some of the best special effects you're ever going to see.
Some of the dialogue is stupid, but hey, you ever see a Star Wars?
There's stupid
dialogue in most movies if you know where to look.
Some of the dialogue clunky? Yes. Is the romance melodramatic? Yes. Is it all effective? Yes.
Everything, I'm sorry, I remember I saw that movie opening weekend, and I thought to myself, it's okay. And then I didn't love it, but like I got what he was putting down. Mm. But at the time, everyone thought it was going to be a huge disaster, not in like the genre way, but in terms of like, it cost a shocking amount of money. And
they needed two studios to fund it. It costs more, I think more than any other film up until that point.
It did.
And it was moved from the summer. You can actually find like popcorn tubs that say summer, 1997.
Yeah. They're posters as well. You can still track it. They're probably worth a lot of money.
Collide with Destiny. And then they changed it into something that looks a little bit more romantic. They moved it to Christmas release. And wouldn't you know, it dominated the box office. It was number one at the box office for months straight.
And that's really been a long time since that happened with pandemic, which is like, there was like The Wretched, I think was like number one for a while, but even that didn't have the Titanic legs.
Well, I think just because nobody else was seeing anything.
Exactly.
I think the number one film at the box office from 2020 was Bad Boys for Life.
Yeah, which is a January release because almost nothing else came out that was like significantly wide. But Titanic didn't have like a huge opening weekend even. It did okay, but it didn't make $100 million. Everyone was like, well, that's that.
But then people don't
have that kind of legs. There's no way it's ever going to make its much money. Became the biggest movie of all time. And one of the reasons people were skeptical is because of Raise the Titanic.
Mm.
This movie was this giant, hugely budgeted, mega potential blockbuster. It was all supposed to capitalize on people's interest in the Titanic. And nobody cared.
Mm.
I don't know what exactly it is about it that failed to capture people's attention. The trailer is not very interesting, but frankly, a lot of trailers for good movies at the time weren't very interesting. So, word of mouth probably must have killed it, I imagine, because once the first wave of people get out of Raise the Titanic, and they just sort of like go...
There's also a sense that a lot of films that come pre-billed as expensive.
Yeah.
People go in, like, ready to pinch their noses.
Mm-hmm.
Waterworld syndrome. If you didn't know that Waterworld was the most expensive film of all time, this was a few years before Titanic, you probably would have thought, that's an okay, dumb, water, Mad Max kind of ripoff thing.
Yeah, it's pretty stupid, it's very watchable. Yeah,
it's fine.
Yeah.
But it became notorious because it was so expensive. They had to build a new set every
day. It's like the audience wants to be argumentative. Like, you spent that much? Show me.
Yeah, wow me. Show you. If you're going
to
spend that much.
Yeah, I need to fucking see it. I need to see it on screen. It's one of the reasons why James Cameron's movie works so well. It's all on screen. Leonardo DiCaprio was not commanding a paycheck at the time. All on screen.
But there are a lot of films that still have the capacity to wow you, but you're still, like, going to go in askance if you know how expensive it is. John Carter, Valerian, Mortal Engines.
Yeah.
These things were gigantic budget movies, some of which have dazzling sequences.
Oh, yeah. Mortal Engines has some incredible visual effects.
That opening sequence where two cities are chasing each other across a landscape.
And
cities on tank treads.
And then there's like a foot chase through a city while like chainsaws the size of skyscrapers are ripping it apart.
Yeah, like there's
some... That shit's a fucking phenomenal... Like, the first act of Mortal Engines is fucking cool. It gets a little formulaic from there on out, but the movie's fine. That opening act is amazing.
The human characters are really boring, but the zombie Frankenstein robot thing... Mr. Shaw,
I love that thing.
That thing was really cool.
Was that Stephen Lang?
What was it, Stephen Lang?
I think it was Stephen Lang, that shit was fucking
whatever
awesome.
It was like in mocap. He was like a CGI creation.
Yeah, but it was a cool character,
Valerian has really dazzling special effects, but, you know, it's French. it feels very European.
It does feel very European, yeah.
And I actually was discussing Valerian on a podcast called Tentpole Trauma with a friend of ours named Sebastian, and... we came to the conclusion that the reason a lot of people stayed away from Valerian is Valerian is non-lethal. You'll notice all the weapons in Valerian incapacitate people or like lock people into pods or weigh down their
hands. The movie isn't trying to be violent.
Yeah, in fact,
it's got a lot of adventure, but it's not trying to be violent.
It espouses non-violence, and we figured that might be one of the main reasons why it didn't catch on with American audience who like the violence. They want to see the killing.
I think the real issue with Valerian, I think Valerian has issues... Beyond that, Dane DeHaan is simply miscast.
I can't argue with that.
There's no denying he's a good actor, but that's a wrong role for him.
Yeah, it's not the kind of role he should have been
playing. You needed
Chris Pine.
You needed Chris Pratt or Chris Pine.
Yeah.
One of any of the Chrises would have been fine. Chris Hemsworth would have been fine. Any of the Chrises.
So, somebody who can play like a little bit more. Like he's like a Han Solo character.
You need a dashing, rogue, and Dane DeHaan is more of like a James Dean type. He's miscast.
He's a little more broody. Yeah.
But beyond that, the thing with that movie is there really isn't a hook. There isn't like a story you can easily explain to people, and if you try, it's like, oh, it's about this little this little tiny animal that poops out clones of things, and it could be the most useful thing in the universe. And so and immediately people's eyes glaze over, like, we don't care. Like, Star Wars is about a kidnapped princess and a weapon that destroys planets. Easy to understand. Easy hook. It's a fairy tale in space.
It's about a city of 1,000 planets, and it's this gigantic space station that's about the size of a planet, and thousands of different worlds have sort of stuck it all together, so it's this big patchwork. Okay, I'm bored already.
Yeah, it's cool to watch.
So cool.
It's cool to watch, but it's really difficult to pitch, unfortunately.
I think people
need to know in a trailer, why do I need to see this?
Well,
that's the thing. Why do I need to... This can't wait. I can only have enough money to see a couple of movies a year. Why is this the one?
That's not the problem with Raise the Titanic.
No.
The plot is in the title. They're going to raise
the clear.
Titanic. Yeah.
The motive is stupid, but who cares?
The motive is we need Byzantium.
We need a MacGuffin.
That's really stupid. There's a MacGuffin on the Titanic, so we need to raise it.
We're going to raise the Titanic, but we need a ticking clock. That's what they needed, and they couldn't think of a better one than that.
So how complex it is or how difficult to pitch it is isn't a problem. It is maybe too simple, in fact. I think the issue is just audience skepticism of expensive projects.
Yeah.
If the movie comes sort of like pre-sold, if it's a sequel, and you can make that as expensive as you like, and we've seen that with, the Avengers films, those things cost hundreds of millions of dollars to make. But those, that's like the 14th, 15th, 20th film in a series that already kind of has a built-in audience. People are excited about it. They're willing. They're not going to be as skeptical of something like that because they know what they're getting.
I also think that the problem with the film is, I think it's two things, but they're directly connected: the protagonist and the tone. I think Dirk Pitt. Again, I haven't read the books. Maybe in the books he's amazing. He's a boring protagonist. He doesn't have interests or passions or anything. He's not funny. He's not romantic. If this was the basic plot, like the bare bones idea you had for an Indiana Jones movie, Indiana Jones needs to find some artifact that was on the Titanic. Sold. Because you can picture like the foot chases on the Titanic as it's being raised and all this cool stuff. You're taking all of these ideas that you had and you're centering them around a dashing, compelling hero. And you're thinking of other stuff you can do with that gimmick.
Yeah.
Well, you're not just raising the Titanic. We're raising the Titanic, and then we're going to do a chase on it. Then we're going to do something else
I'm thinking of Dirk Pitt as sort of like an Indiana Jones type character.
That's my point.
Like an Alan Quartermain type character.
Yeah, some pulpy and adventure hero.
Think of the structure of Raiders of the Lost Ark, which is a serial, like a serialized narrative in feature form.
Sure.
First of all, there's an introductory sequence where we get to see what the hero does when he's not doing the main story. Mm-hmm. That's not in Raise the Titanic. We don't get to see a Dirk Pitt adventure in Medias Res.
It almost looks like we are, but it's actually another character who disappears from the narrative right away. There's some guy in like this tiny island in the Arctic, and he like finds, he's digging in the Antarctic, or he's digging in the Arctic, and he finds a corpse of a guy, and then he gets attacked by Russians. And it's not Dirk Pitt.
Yeah, that's not Dirk Pitt.
That's a huge mistake.
So
you should have been Dirk Pitt.
Establishing a little bit who Dirk Pitt was crucial, and they didn't have that.
Yeah.
Secondly, you think of once Indiana Jones, he's hired by these suits to go find the Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah.
And every time he gets a step closer, there's bad guys, first of all, who are trying to chase them. Now, there are bad guys in Raise the Titanic. It's the Russians.
But they're not on site. There's like a spy, but it's not like there's no danger involved.
Yeah, in Raiders of the Lost Ark, we get to see them close on the good guys' heels throughout the movie. Yeah. So he has to keep on the move.
And whenever it gets a little boring, they fight.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a fight. And also, every time he finds another clue to like where the Ark of the Covenant is, the stakes are raised a little bit, and the narrative changes a little bit. Like, we found where this is. Now we're going to have a digging sequence. There's a lot of variety in this because it's supposed to be a serial.
Every new development leads to new challenges.
Yeah. What if? Then what?
Yeah. To quote Wiener Dog.
To quote the movie Wiener Dog.
Which is actually a pretty good philosophy.
Good writing advice,
just ask what if, then ask then what.
Yeah. Yeah, and then this happens. Then this happens. Then what? Yeah, keep on thinking that out.
Yeah, Raise the Titanic is really good at the first half.
Yeah.
Bad at the second.
So there's no sense of raising stakes that if they fail to raise the Titanic, something will be lost or the bad guys will gain something.
Even this laser defense system is like a hypothetical. It's not like we need it now moment.
Like the Russians are building this weapon and we need this in like X number of days they'll vaporize Detroit. You know, whatever it is.
Yeah, like that would be relevant. But here it's just like we want better missile defense system because it's the Cold War. You can't just fall back on it's the Cold War. You need to actually have something about to happen.
No, I understand Dirk Pitt is not the same kind of character as Indiana Jones. He's a little bit more. He's a much more modern character. I was just looking at his Wikipedia page. Evidently, he collects classic cars. So he's a little bit more like a Green Hornet. Like he's a rich playboy kind of character.
Okay. So based on our limited research,
but I do know how adventure characters ought to behave in adventure films to make it exciting. And there's myriad ways to do it. But Raise the Titanic doesn't give us any of those things.
When you can look at a million different movies and you can boil them down to similar storytelling ideas. This is what a lot of screenwriting classes are about, is trying to teach people to think about stories, not get caught up in the weeds and the minutia, but try to think about stories in their grandest sense so that you can plot them out, so that you can plan them. And some people have a really good innate sense of that. Often it's developed through many years of study or at least practice. Sometimes people just watch enough movies that they get it without even realizing it. But you look at adventure movies of any kind, and Raising the Titanic is clearly an adventure movie of a sort. you need to constantly change and raise the stakes. You need to constantly challenge the characters, and you need to, if there's going to be an antagonist, they need to be active. You can't just have them show up at the end after a couple of scenes of them talking at a dinner party. It's like, oh, they're raising the Titanic? No, we should do something later.
Even if they're not on screen, we need like some CIA guy to come in and say the Russians are getting let us know something,
please.
Like, we found this evidence. Here's a piece of paper. We don't even have to see it. He looks at it and just have him react. Oh crap! We need to hurry. You know, something that makes us excited.
This is like watching like a History Channel documentary where they decided to do some like historical reenactment scenes, but they decided to get a little too creative with those and added this whole weird subplot.
Yeah.
Like, that's what this feels like, because it's very interested in the tech stuff, the nerdy stuff about raising the Titanic. And honestly, when they're just focusing on that, it's not bad. Like, I actually like the idea of we're trying to solve an impossible problem. And I'm fascinated by people solving impossible problems. If the writer can come up with a way to solve it, kudos. I want to see that.
And indeed, there are film directors who deal with that kind of meticulous, mechanical kind of viewpoint. David Mamet is one of them.
Yep.
He's a very technical film. Like, he deals with characters, but he also is very technical when it comes to shop.
Yeah, well, also when it comes to his stories as well. Like, he's very interested in like, what the characters do for a living, and what they do for a living is deceive, so he comes up with those in an almost mathematical way.
And I feel like nobody's better at that kind of technical world building than Steven Soderbergh.
I thought you were going to say Michael Mann.
Michael Mann, too.
Thief, Heat.
I haven't seen Thief, but yeah. Michael Mann, similar sort of thing.
But Soderbergh, you're going to say.
I believe Soderbergh could do something like Raise the Titanic, because he'd fill it with a lot of interesting characters, for one. He'd get, because he knows every actor in Hollywood, he'd get a really interesting cast of not just Dirk Pitts, but like a whole ensemble sort of raising the Titanic together. And we would see that these are people who are really good at their job, and we can get involved in their shop. And I feel like this is a technical film. It's trying to be really scientifically accurate or whatever. But I don't see the characters passionate about the science.
Right. So here's what I would do. I would get a filmmaker who understood that, frankly, this whole idea of raising the Titanic in order to find some treasure in there is missing the point of the Titanic.
Is that so, a missing mystery? Or?
No, it's that, it's actually a human story, and that actually matters. It's not just this technical exercise.
Yeah.
So what you do is you have a filmmaker who opens the movie with people looking for the Titanic, looking for some kind of treasure, and then over the course of the film, much like they meet Alec Guinness and he tells them little stories about the Titanic, but you focus the entire movie around someone telling a story of what it was like to actually be on that Titanic and watch it sink, so that the people who were on this scavenger hunt mission understand the greater context of it and actually learn something from their adventure. And I'm thinking you get someone like James Cameron to direct. Because if you think about it, there's some structural similarities here.
That could work.
I think there's some structural similarities here, and I wouldn't be surprised if James Cameron had read the novel or seen the movie. Well, because there's a few minor, you know, things that connect.
If you ever see a Night to Remember, which is another Titanic movie,
there's
lines of dialogue from A Night to Remember that are in Titanic. Because it was a matter of record, like that there were survivors and this a lot of people, things reported
on. A lot of survivors, not enough by far, but like there were quite a few survivors. Also, the movie, there were two Titanic movies in the 50s, and I always get them confused. I can never remember which one I saw. I saw one, I didn't see the other. There's A Night to Remember, and there's one that's literally just called Titanic.
Just called Titanic, yeah.
One of those made me cry like nobody's business. Because there's this, I think it's Titanic, there's a whole subplot about a man who finds out that his son, he's on the ship with his wife and his son, but he finds out his son isn't his. And he didn't know that.
Oh, that's got to be Titanic.
I think it's Titanic, because there's this incredible subplot where he finds out that his son isn't his. And he's really fucked up by this, and it's probably going to destroy their marriage. But the son doesn't know what's going on. He just loves his dad. So at the end of the movie, when the Titanic is sinking, this guy does the thing to do. I put my wife and the child on a boat, and I'm going to sit here with the brandy and wait to die. Because there's not enough room for everybody. And that's the way it goes. And he's sitting there, so and he's very sad, and he's lost everything. And just as everything's going down, the lifeboats are going away, his son runs up to him because he missed his dad.
Oh my
God. Because the kid, it didn't matter to the kid.
And the boy loved his daddy.
Oh my God. That is such good melodrama. Oh my God. I'm about to cry just thinking about that. Oh, that's one of the saddest endings of any movie I've ever seen It's incredible. But Rise of the Titanic is not. Is it awful? No, it's just kind of dull. Like, it's not like the worst thing ever. I can just see why it didn't make money. It's not very interesting. It's a shame, really, because there's neat stuff here if you did.
The pacing isn't... maybe they were going for something like a little bit more adult and a little less pulpy, but in so doing, they kind of drained it of a lot of its potential excitement.
Yeah.
It's an implausible premise, so maybe roll with that implausibility a little bit.
Yeah, go nuts.
Have fun. If you're going to make a movie about making a big drill that's going down to restart the core of the Earth to stop spinning with a nuclear bomb.
Which admittedly we wouldn't do for another, like, 20 years.
Make it a little silly.
Yeah.
The movie came out in 2003. The core is a very stupid movie. It's a very stupid movie. It's incredibly watchable, but it's very stupid.
That. I am looking forward to... Have you seen the trailer for Moonfall?
No, but I... I tend not to watch trailers, but I'm really tempted to watch
the Moonfall. I think you should watch the trailer for Moonfall because it looks incredibly stupid, and I can't wait.
Roland Emmerich's next Earth destruction flick.
If you're going to do a disaster... Listen, disaster movies are a little too close to home right now. If you're going to do it, you got to do it real stupid.
Either have a Moonfall or a Geostorm.
Yeah, anything...
Otherwise, don't waste my time.
Thank you. So I'm looking forward to it. But anyway... next time on Critically Reclaimed, we will be talking about, we'll be going over to Disney Plus, and we're going to be looking at live-action Disney movies from the 90s that one or both of us missed. Mm-hmm. If you head on over to patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, you'll be able to vote for one of the following movies. We will watch whichever one wins the poll. The nominees are Camp Nowhere, which is about a camp run by Christopher Lloyd, that I assume is quite hard to find. There's Heavyweights. Another camp movie. This one with Ben Stiller running a camp for large kids, and the kids take over the thing. I've actually never seen that one. Everyone keeps telling me I need to. Maybe I will this week. It all depends on you. That Darn Cat. Not the original with Annette Funicello, but the remake with Christina Ricci and Dougie Doug. From the writers of Man on the Moon and Ed Wood. It's interesting.
They had to pay the bills.
Hey.
They also wrote Problem Child.
Bless them. And then their last nominee, which you could vote for, is the Disney version of The Three Musketeers, starring Kiefer Sutherland, Charlie Sheen, Oliver Platt, Tim Curry, and Chris O'Donnell.
Hmm.
Boom. Those are your options.
Did it all for one and all for love.
Mm-hmm.
I hate that song.
You hate that? You hate the best song ever written?
Yes.
Okay, interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I have no mm-hmm. tolerance for your drivel.
How do you feel about the Don Juan DeMarco theme?
About as much.
Yeah. That, okay.
Let's see. So the Three Musketeers song was like the unholy trinity of of Rod Stewart, Bryan Adams, and Sting.
Yeah.
Who did the Don Juan DeMarco theme?
I think it was Bryan Adams.
It was also Bryan Adams?
I think Bryan Adams did the Don Juan DeMarco, and I think Bryan Adams also did Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Oh, no.
Bryan Adams was kind of the man for a while there, yeah.
No, the Canadian government has apologized for Bryan Adams on several occasions.
Anyway, those are the nominees. You can head over to patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork to vote for that. You also get a lot of other exclusive shows if you sign up. If you want to talk about anything we discussed on this episode, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We might read your email on an upcoming episode of We've Got Mail. Whitney, what is our P.O. box? If you want to send us a snailish mailish.
Send us an actual physical letter. We love to get those. You can write into the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641-565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah. And we're on Twitter @CriticAcclaim. I am @William Bibbiani.
I'm @Whitney Seibold.
If you're listening to this podcast in a timely manner, we're currently having a Labor Day sale over at Salt Cat Soap, the Etsy store I run with my partner, M. Lampas da Silva. We have a lot of designer soaps that we make. They smell amazing. They look really, really great. I can say this because Michelle does most of them. I'm really, really proud of them. And there's a sale going on all Labor Day. Check them out. Thank you, everybody, who's already bought some soap. The reviews have been really, really positive so far, and that means a lot to us. Whitney also has another podcast.
I do, over on The Screen's Margins, which is a podcasting network run by the venerable B. Peterson. We talk about films on Ovid, the streaming service Ovid. The podcast is called All About Ovid, spelled with all O's.
Good luck Googling that.
Well, you Google it right, you get it first click.
You Google it wrong. Have you tried Googling it wrong?
No, like all, yeah, with all. I'm gonna see if this, all about Ovid.
I'm actually gonna Google this right now. I just want to see if
O B O U.
You keep saying it's ungoogleable. I want to see if it actually comes up.
But yeah, they and I talk about what we see on Ovid. We recently discovered just an utter masterwork called "Too Late to Die Young" by a Chilean filmmaker named Domingo Sotomayor. Please watch "Too Late to Die Young." It is so good. It's a film about a well-to-do commune living off the grid, sort of living off the land in houses that weren't really completely built and some dodgy water supply. And it focuses on three kids who are living there and just sort of their experiences on how they're in this nebulous period in Chilean history after the fall of Pinochet, but before the rise of the democratic government. So it's all this really wonderful political allegory that as it plays into as a metaphor for adolescence, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful movie. B and I talk about that movie.
Nice. If you type in "All About Ovid" and spell it all correctly, you don't get anything. You actually get a podcast about the actual classical writer.
Yeah, okay.
If you type in "All About Ovid" with all the O's, Google is like, "Did you mean all about COVID?"
Oh no!
So please write it incorrectly, all with an O.
About with an O at the beginning, with two O's actually,
both beginning and Ovid O V I D. Look for it. Once you put that in, it's easy. You find it, but please check it out because everyone's always like, "Well, we always talk about the same movies in the realm, in the discourse." We need to talk about the films that aren't being talked about.
And that was sort of the mission statement of B. Peterson's
exactly.
The Screen's Margins.
Exactly.
If we focus on the mainstream, what's on the margins?
Exactly. So kudos to that. And if we get anything, Twitter. No, I think that's it. So thank you everybody for listening. We hope you enjoyed Raising the Titanic. And we will see you when we do
when we further reclaim something.
Yeah, when we sink that darn cat. Maybe, if it wins. I don't know.